Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the war on terror and U.S. foreign policy. We'll be joined by Robert Baer, who spent 25 years running agents from inside the CIA's Director of Operations from 1976 to 1997, working against Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist organizations. He was considered by Seymour Hersh as perhaps the best on-the-ground field officer in the Middle East. He needs to say he's one of the few American in government who actually speak Farsi and Arabic. Robert Baer is also the author of two New York Times bestsellers, Sleeping with the Devil, which is about the Saudi royal family and its relationship to the United States, and See No Evil, which recounts Bob Baer's years as a top CIA operative in Iraq between the wars. And See No Evil, of course, was the basis of the acclaimed film Syriana, which earned George Clooney the Oscar for his portrayal of Bob Baer. And Bob Baer writes regularly for Time.com and is a contributor to Vanity Fair and Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East. And his new book just out is The Devil We Know, Dealing with a New Iranian Superpower. And this is an insight into the consequences of George Bush's folly in the Middle East and how much he has unwittingly empowered Iran and how Iran is the emerging power in that region, thanks in part to the blunders of the neocons. And then we will be addressing the economy with Dr. James Galbraith, who teaches economics at the LBJ School at the University of Texas, Austin, at which he's also the director of the Inequality Project, and he serves as the chief on the board of economists for peace and security. He writes a column called Iconoclast for Mother Jones and occasional commentary for other publications, including the Texas Observer, the American Prospect, and The Nation. His new book is The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. Nobel Prize-winning economist Dr. Joseph Stiglitz has said of this book, "The Predator State shows how to break the spell that conservatives have cast over the minds of liberals and everyone else for many years." Now that the economy is tanked, obviously they should have taken his advice. But the long and the short of it is there'll be an awful lot to talk about in terms of where we're going to get out of this, because this is an unfolding tragedy and disaster affecting everybody in this country. And, of course, the super rich, to some extent, already got bailed out by the $700 billion, which is effectively was an inside job on Wall Street. And as you've seen from the stock exchange this week, it's done nothing to stop the decline of the economy in general. So we're looking into what is really going on here with these rescue attempts and where it may end up, given that the head of the IMF has warned about the global economy unraveling. I'm now speaking with Robert Baer, who spent 20 years running agents from inside the CIA's Director of Operations from 1976 to 1997, working against Hezbollah, Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist organizations. He was considered by Seymour Hersh as perhaps the best on-the-ground field officer in the Middle East. Robert Baer is the author of two New York Times bestsellers, Sleeping with the Devil, about the Saudi royal family and its relationship to the United States, and See No Evil, which recounts Robert Baer's years as a top CIA operative in Iraq and other theaters. See No Evil, of course, was the basis of the acclaimed film Syriana, which earned George Clooney the Oscar for his portrayal of Robert Baer. Robert Baer writes regularly for Time.com, is a contributor to Vanity Fair, The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post, and is considered one of the foremost authorities on the Middle East, having unique qualifications in terms of speaking Farsi and Arabic. His new book, just out, The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. And thank you for joining us, Robert Baer. The Iranian superpower, of course, how much have we unwittingly unleashed the Iranian superpower, or at least the Bush administration, I should say?
Well, it was unwitting to the Bush administration, but the fact that we went into Iraq and the fact that we went into Afghanistan and destroyed the enemies of Iran, we empowered them. We turned them into a superpower, if you like. You know, for 8 years, the Iranians fought Saddam Hussein to a standstill, and at some point, we thought that was the end of Iran, Khomeini's revolution. And in the meantime, they went on to fight in Lebanon and so forth, and they did survive. And all of a sudden, in 2003, March, We invaded and destroyed Iraq. That was the shield of the Arabs. That was the counterbalance to an Iranian empire. And we did this, as you said, unwittingly.
And the paradox that you bring out in your new book, The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower, Robert Baer, is in terms of our dealings or our non-dealings with the current regime, is that you bring up this Iranian paradox that they want to both humble us and work with us.
Well, they want to be acknowledged, this newfound power. And rightfully, they want to be acknowledged. They're saying, look, we are the only country in the Gulf with an army of 1 million soldiers. They can put 1 million soldiers into uniform very quickly. We are the only power that's lived within its border for thousands of years. All these new states like Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and the rest of them, they were invented in the 20th century, and they're not real states. So what they're saying is we want to be acknowledged. It's inevitable, so do it now, and don't treat us like a pariah state. Don't say you are part of the axis of evil, and here are the preconditions to come back to our state system. Now, since the financial crisis and since Iraq, they're just saying this is ridiculous, and you will be forced to deal with us.
Well, of course, the two presidential candidates, Obama and McCain, are almost in competition, arguing about not dealing with Iran and the extent to which Obama would talk to them but not necessarily sit down with a man who John McCain continually says refers to Israel as a stinking corpse. Notwithstanding that the debate between these two men about this issue has been childlike, what's your sense of when, in fact, the United States will get serious? Or if?
We're going to get serious after the election in January when it's apparent that we're going to lose in both Iraq and Afghanistan. The surge is a joke. The surge, I know this is going completely against conventional wisdom, worked because the Sunnis in Iraq turned against Al-Qaeda, turned against the radicals, against these jihadists from Saudi Arabia. They didn't want a civil war, and neither did the Shia. It remains that we are sitting on a volcano in Iraq. We cannot draw down our troops, as the military has admitted. We are sitting on a volcano in Afghanistan. No one has the appetite for a third war against Iran. And I think what's going to happen is we're just going to show up in Tehran and ask for terms of settlement. I mean, that's a bit of an exaggeration. But we can deal with the Iranians. They've been very rational for the last 12 years, since the bombing of Khobar Barracks in Saudi Arabia in 1996. They have refrained from terrorism. They have refrained from a confrontation in the Gulf with our carrier task force. The problem we have is Ahmadinejad. He is bipolar. He's probably out of his mind in a certain sense, but he is not the executive authority in Iran. It's been said over and over again. It's Khamenei, the spiritual leader. It's an informal Politburo of military officers who are rational. And I think once we sit down at the table with them, we're not going to like the terms, but they're terms that we can meet.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, the author of a new book, The Devil We Know, Dealing with the Iranian Superpower. But it seems to me, though, that the indictment against Bush and the neocons, who are the brains behind him, is not only is it overwhelming, it is continuing, and you cannot discount the possibility of a McCain-Palin presidency, or indeed a Palin presidency. Let me just tick up a couple of examples. When after this, the statue of Saddam fell in April 10th, 2003, in Baghdad, shortly after, the Iranian government sent a delegation through the Swiss to the White House to say, everything's on the table. We want to negotiate. They were terrified that they'd be next, and they were shocked at how quickly the United States deposed of this enemy that took them 8 years to fight to a standstill. And they thought they'd be next. They apparently told the White House that everything's on the table, including all the nuclear issues, and we have authority from the Supreme Leader. And what happened? Cheney gave them the back of the hand and said, we don't talk to evil, and kicked them out. I mean, talk about the shoe being on the other foot now. I mean, we're floundering trying to figure out what we can do about their enrichment program, and they were prepared to give it up.
It was the march of folly. This whole, I mean, what occurred after the invasion, you know, in the 5 intervening years. Well, let me put it this way: to the point now that Ryan Crocker 2 weeks ago said that it was Iran that is blocking a status of forces agreement in Iraq. I mean, talk about a wake-up call. You know, that government in Baghdad is beholden to Iran. Not that they particularly want to be, but they know that we are going to leave one day, and when we do, it's the Iranians are going to either be the protectors of Iraq or the invaders. So we've wasted these 5 years fighting an insurgency that we can't beat at the end of the day. Or we stay there for 30 more years. Either way, it's unacceptable, especially in a financial meltdown, to be spending $3 trillion on these wars when we need the money here.
But the next, when I was mentioning the serial indictments against the neocons and who still are in power, and they apparently are the dominant force behind the McCain foreign policy, given that Randy Scheuneman, his chief foreign policy advisor, was the go-to guy for Atma Chalabi, your old nemesis. you know, look what they just did in Georgia. They encouraged this reckless Shakasvili, who was paying Scheuneman, who was a lobbyist for the government. They walked into Putin's sucker punch. They thought, you know, using the cover of the Olympics, they, you know, vainglorious. And maybe Putin was right that it was all a wag the dog to help McCain's campaign. We don't know that, but what we do know is that it was a catastrophe. And that now Putin's picked off more of their territory. He's already picked off Chechnya so that there won't be any pipelines. It's all about the pipelines. The only pipeline to the West that Putin doesn't control is the one through Georgia, and now he's breathing down the neck of that pipeline. The Israelis are building an airfield there to attack Iran. I can't imagine that they're going to get away with that. So the whole thing, just in terms of the neocon plans, has completely blown up in their face. So the recklessness that we've endured for the last 8 years appears to be, will continue
it would absolutely continue. I mean, they still believe that we can go to war against the world, not only against the Sunni, which that's what the war in Iraq was, against Saddam. He was a Sunni, the 20% minority. They also intend to go to war against the Shia, which is led by Iran now. So we're going to go to war against 1.3 billion people and against the former Soviet Union, all for what? And it's a war we can't pay for. It's a war we can't pay for. We don't have the soldiers. We'd have to institute the draft. It's just continuing this disastrous foreign policy, which is unprecedented in American history.
But this wasn't the idea, though, that, you know, that one of the reasons we got into the Caspian was to get a hedge against our total dependence on Middle East oil. Bush blundering into Iraq has made Middle East oil more vulnerable and much, much more expensive. We've seen that. Now their screw-up in Georgia has made Caspian oil equally vulnerable, and the Nabucco pipeline, which was supposed to be Europe's hedge against Putin's complete control of the gas flowing out of the former Soviet Union, that one's unlikely to be built. And hasn't the recent Georgian disaster driven Russia and Iran much closer?
Oh, absolutely. The Russians are sending weapons clandestinely to Iran, as they are to Venezuela, as they are to Syria. I mean, they're building a port in Tartus, the Russians. What we've done is created a block against the United States, against American foreign policy. The Europeans are neutral. Actually, they're terrified. But just add up the oil. I mean, this is a hobby horse that I've been on for a long time, but we are addicted to oil, whether we like it or not. But you take the 17 million barrels of oil, which are now under the shadow of Iran, because Iran can remove the tankers passing through Hormuz. They can take 17 million barrels of oil off the market instantly. The Russians now have the Caspian Sea pipeline. under their thumb. They can sabotage it, take it out. That's 1 million barrels, and plus the 5 million barrels that Russia exports. And fine, oil today is heading towards $70 a barrel, but overnight, an embargo against us could take off, 25 million barrels, something like that, which would drive the price of oil to $12 a gallon, basically. Which, if you think, you know, if you're wondering whether we're facing depression now, they could ensure a depression.
So, what's the alternative, given that we've had disastrous leadership in this country, and I think it's pretty apparent to everybody that there's no leadership now, as the economy seems to be careening out of control. Let's assume there's no continuation of the Bush foreign policy, and McCain and Palin don't get elected. What's your advice to Obama?
Well, when you're in a hole, stop digging. Mm-hmm. Go to Tehran without preconditions. Give them the Persian Gulf. It's called the Persian Gulf for a reason. The Iranians have a consistent history of selling oil on the market, not interrupting. They depend upon oil. They cannot block it off irrationally. We care about oil. I mean, at the end of the day, do we care if the Iranians are the predominant voice in Iraq? We don't. What we don't want them to do is build a nuclear weapon for two reasons. One is the Israelis will react, and two is it'd start a weapons race in the Gulf. The Saudis will want one next. We sit them down and say, all right, in exchange for not building a bomb, here's what you got to do. We don't have a choice. We cannot go to war against 1.3 billion Muslims. We can't afford it. We don't have enough troops and so forth. It is a very natural and logical step, especially since the Iranians have gotten out of the terrorism business. They've gotten out because they know they have more to lose than gain.
The book itself indicates to me, Bob Baer, that in many ways we backed the wrong horse in that part of the world, that we should have backed the Shia in Iran, and that the Sunni that we've backed, particularly in the form of the Saudi royal family, are becoming increasingly corrupt and irrelevant. So do you see a day when Iran's shadow will be over Mecca and Medina?
Well, I think so. I mean, we have... In 1979, you have to put it in context, there wasn't much choice. It was a surprise to everybody, academics, the CIA, everybody, how quickly the Shah fell. It was a surprise, the vehemence of this revolution. But what we failed to do was catch up with the changes in Iran. It became a more rational, calculating power. We completely have to redo our foreign policy in the Middle East, because Saudi Arabia, yes, it's pumped oil very cheaply. The Saudi royal family is very friendly with Washington, but the fact remains 15 of those hijackers were Saudis. We still don't know who recruited them. We still don't know where they got the money from, because the Saudis won't tell us. Pakistan isn't long for this world, the Pakistan we know. If you like, the Sunnis are the equivalent of anarchists. They have no head. They have no pope to guide them as a sect. The Iranians do. They're fairly disciplined. And it's time to just rejigger the alliances. We have to deal with the reality, the facts.
Bob Baer, it seems that so much of our focus is misplaced and we're chasing ghosts. You just wrote a piece for Time magazine suggests that we're likely to blunder into another war. We're risking a war with Pakistan, which is a country on the edge of civil war.
We've been on a ghost hunt for the last 7 years looking for bin Laden. Bin Laden, the evidence is likely he's dead. I've asked my ex-colleagues who have been on his trail, and I expected them. What I expect them to tell me is, listen, we know he's alive, but I'm not going to tell you why. Because you're not inside anymore, which is fine. But what I got instead was half assumed he was dead, half assumed he was alive, but the word is assumed. They don't know. And with that kind of evidence, and the fact that he's not appeared on a legitimate tape, you know, last one he appeared, his hair was dyed, which is not the bin Laden we know. It's probably a doctored tape. He's dead. So what are we going to do? Go into Pakistan and destroy anybody with the potential for violence? that's 40 million Pashtuns we'd have to get rid of. This is insane what we're doing. And you can't fight a war with Predators and Hellfire missiles. This is Conrad's Heart of Darkness. You just don't shell that part of the world and expect the problem to go away. And anyhow, I mean, these people can't come to the United States. I mean, these Pashtuns live up in these mountains, cannot get visas. They cannot get here. They are not going to attack us. This war has been a distraction for domestic political reasons. You know, it got Bush reelected in 2004, and they keep on doing it, and McCain thinks he's going to do the same thing.
So not only is bin Laden a myth, the extent to which he may not be alive, and he's largely irrelevant. Al-Qaeda itself is largely a myth, isn't it? I mean, McCain says, I'm going to get Al-Qaeda. I'm going to get him. I know how to win wars.
What is he talking about? 9/11 was a franchised operation. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, in his interrogation, said, listen, I never swore loyalty. I just showed up in Afghanistan. I said I was going to do this operation. Bin Laden basically blessed it. The hijackers showed up. But it's a franchise operation. These people do not carry ID cards. There's not in lines of control. Even Hayden, the CIA director, has said that bin Laden's not in day-to-day charge of this organization, which tells me he doesn't know who is in charge. It's gone away. Saudi Arabia had a close brush with death after 9/11. A bunch of explosions went off, their car bombs. But it's gone away. These movements come up in Islam from time to time. They're very radical extremists. They kill a lot of people, and then they go away. And that's what we've seen, is this thing has gone away. We are now fighting the wrong war. We can only make things worse.
So if indeed we're chasing ghosts and we're lost in the shadows here, what should our real focus be?
Our real focus should be have, and I'll put this very bluntly, we should have a surrogate in the Gulf that's watching the Gulf, and that would be Iran. It's not the Gulf, the rim of the Gulf is 90% Shia. These guys are the ones that inhabit the areas around the oil fields. They are a fairly benign group of people right now, and they should be doing it. There's nothing wrong with conducting foreign policy through surrogates. The other choice is to position 1 million American soldiers in the Gulf and fight a 30-year war, which at the end we will lose.
But, Bob Baer, it seems highly unlikely that we'll either have the imagination or the ability to make some kind of an alliance with Iran because of Israel, with whom we have a de facto alliance. And I noticed what Olmert said when he left office. He finally started to speak the truth. He's basically saying that the Israeli military is run by megalomaniacs, and they think that they can go to war anywhere. And he also talked about the disastrous negligence of the Palestinian issue and how it's going to eat away at that state.
Oh, I think there's no doubt that in the first quarter next year, 2009, if we don't do something about Iran, Israel will attack and draw us into World War III. They've said it. I hear it over and over again. These people say we have to do something about Iran in Lebanon, Iran in Syria, and Iran in Iraq. What the Israelis are telling us is that if you don't do something, we will. And you have to look at it from their standpoint. It's an existential threat, Iran. Iran unbridled, left to go the way it is a threat to Israel. And they don't care about our stock market. They don't care about the rest of it. They will strike. But what we need to do is step into that breach and bring Iran back to a country we can deal with. But letting it drift, as apparently Obama and McCain are going to let this go, will ensure that we get into World War III. It will ensure that the Iranians take out tanker traffic through Hormuz. And this is the worst fear of the State Department, the CIA right now, is a drift.
But you know a lot of the senior Israeli people in their intelligence that you used to work with. What do they think about your thesis, which is, hey, you know, we got it wrong. We're backing the wrong horse here.
The Israelis are furious. They said, you have turned Iran into a hegemon in the Gulf. You have to solve it. You know, you have done nothing about Hezbollah in Lebanon, and we've paid the price because the neocons are always ready to fight these wars in the Middle East to the last Israeli. And trust me, the Israelis see it this way. So what they're saying is you have to go back to a real politic, and you have to, and I'll say it again, you have to do something about Iran, either corral it in or ally with it or call it whatever you want, or we will, because the Israelis were defeated in the 2006 war, the Second Lebanon War, as they call it. They were defeated, and they know it, and they have to do something about it. And that's the backbone of the Israeli argument.
But the only way they could take on Iran would be, they can't do it conventionally. They'd have to use nuclear weapons to take out.
Yeah, which, of course, would draw us into the war whether we like it or not. I would rather pick a war if we had to fight Iran. Say they were insane and we had to fight them. I would rather pick a war of our choosing rather than one initiated by Israel.
So this is the challenge facing the two candidates, one of whom is already proven to be as more reckless, if that's possible, than George W. Bush, and the other one who's basically desperately trying to prove that he's a blind supporter of Israel. So I don't know.
He's not a blind supporter of Israel. He's a blind supporter of the American lobby for Israel. It's two different species of people. The Israelis, you talk to them, they know exactly what they're talking about. They know who these people are, and they make an enormous amount of sense. It is the neocons in this country who refuse to look at the facts that's got us into trouble and the Israelis. And you know, my book has been embraced by the realists so far. I've been getting emails from Israel. You know, people in the Knesset and the Defense Committee, they love it. I mean, they may not like my solutions. They may think that I'm, exaggerating the rationality of the Iranians, but they love it because it identifies the problem. But, you know, right now we are so tied up in this financial crisis, we're not even thinking about it, really.
Right. Well, just in closing, Bob Baer, you spent early this year, you spent a month traveling through the Middle East and Europe interviewing car bombers, collectively some of the greatest mass murderers of the 20th century. And what you came away with is the certainty that the car bomb is unstoppable. It's a detectable only if every car moving around a city is stopped and inspected. So just in closing, give us a sense of this future that we're facing in terms of our so-called national security. We're wasting $612 billion on useless military equipment. And the low-tech, remember the 9/11 guys used box cutters, so...
Yeah, one car bomb tomorrow morning in Manhattan would bring financial markets down, what's left of them, and would change the course of this election. And McCain would be our president. That's going to cost you $250, you know, providing you steal the car. That's what the whole thing will cost you. That's how fragile things are right now.
Well, I thank you for leaving us on
such a happy note.
But your book, as you pointed out, the senior Israeli military intelligence people are reading it. It's something that we should be reading here in this country, the consequences of our appalling lack of leadership and the folly of our leaders in the last year have brought about the new Iranian superpower, the devil we know. The new book by Bob Baer. Thanks again for joining us, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking to Robert Baer, the author of the new book, The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Dr. James Galbraith, who teaches economics at the LBJ School at the University of Texas in Austin, at which he's also the director of the Inequality Project. Dr. Galbraith serves as the chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. He writes a column called Iconoclast for Mother Jones and occasional commentary on many other publications, including The Texas Observer, The American Prospect, and The Nation. His new book is The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. Nobel Prize-winning economist Dr. Joseph Stiglitz has said of this book, The Predator State shows how to break the spell the conservatives have cast over the minds of liberals and everyone else for many years. Dr. Galbraith, I would think what's happening on Wall Street now has broken a number of spells. Do you think much of the touchstones of Republican economics, supply side deregulation, surely they're dead on arrival now, aren't they?
There's certainly spell breaking been going on in on a wholesale basis. I finished The Predator State in the end of 2007, but toward the end, I focused pretty heavily on the problem of deregulation in particular and the way in which it tends to subvert the way markets function. And I give a little bit of a description of how this had worked specifically in housing finance with the development of subprime and basically toxic mortgage-backed securities, which are at the root of the present crisis. So that part of the analysis turned out to be quite apropos of the developments of the last several weeks.
And indeed, we spoke about a year ago when the subprime began to sort of raise its ugly head, if you will, not that it hadn't been beneath the surface there for some time. And you came out with a very cogent list of moves that could be made on the part of the President of the United States to stem this or staunch this disaster. Then you, at the end, you said, but none of this will happen. I mean, we seem to have literally an absentee president.
Although it's clear that the Bush administration is finished and much of the recovery from this disaster is going to fall to the next administration. But I think I may have been a little too pessimistic. I didn't anticipate the extent to which the speed with which this meltdown would occur over the last month. And some of the things which I put into an op-ed piece in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago have already been picked up and are part of the program of action, including efforts to raise the increase the amount of deposit insurance so that people feel more secure in their bank accounts, to protect money market funds, and otherwise to make sure that the financial system has as much liquidity as it needs. I think progress toward that has been a bit slower than I would have liked, but there's certainly been more progress in the last 2 weeks than there was before.
But it does look as if the first $700 billion that we all know how that was argued over on the Hill and how John McCain rushed in to save the day, suspended his campaign, and then went ahead and unsuspended it. And then the Republicans still blocked it for a while and a number of Democrats, and it finally passed. But then no sooner does it pass, the stock market starts to unravel with even more dramatic drops. And I'm wondering, and a lot of commentators at the time said, this $700 billion is not going to address the underlying problem of the frozen credit market. So where did that $700 billion go?
Well, the $700 billion has not yet been spent.
Sure,
it takes the Treasury longer to do that than they've had
right.
So far. What we learned from the debate was that John McCain has no leadership position in the Republican Party. He came in to posture as the person who would bring the package together and discovered that the Republican caucus in the House decided to go a different direction and basically rejected that, did not play along in the little game, in the little drama he was staging. So that was a very interesting political development. What's happened substantively is that there's been a move away from the original conception of the Paulson plan, which is to go out and buy up all of these bad assets, pay too much for them, and hope some of it sticks in the financial system, to something that's much more sensible and targeted, which is to buy shares, preferred equity, in the troubled banks, in the banks that are most troubled by this, and in order to protect the financial system. Protecting the financial system is the essential thing. There is, in fact, no way that one can actually protect the stock market. That's just a reality that we're in. The stock market is a reflection of the larger economy and also the troubles, this financial panic that's been sweeping Europe. Until those issues are dealt with by much larger, more comprehensive measures than the Paulson plan, we aren't going to get out of this.
So Dr. James Galbraith, if we're in a situation of economic triage, is this being done by skilled surgeons, or is it being done by medical orderlies?
Well, I mean, one of the themes of the predator state is that it's being done by carnivores. There may be some medical orderlies present around the operating table, but there's still a fair number of players whose instincts are purely for themselves to grab what they can, that's a major problem of this administration. The administration has spent 7.5 years deregulating, desupervising, basically saying to the financial sector that anything goes. You can sell any asset, no matter toxic, and you don't have, we're not going to come after you. Now we have the same players basically trying to keep the system from unraveling completely in the dying months of this administration. There's really nothing can be done except to hope that the system itself hangs together until we get a new group of players with a new philosophy in place.
But that's quite a way off. That's January the 21st.
That's January the 21st, yeah. A little earlier for a new Congress, but basically, yes, January the 21st. The beginning of the restoration of confidence is the restoration of trust. And in order to restore trust, you basically have to have a team in place who are trustworthy. And that's, of course, a very great difficulty that this administration cannot overcome. And I don't think Senator McCain could overcome it if he became president, because he basically comes out of the same political tradition.
Well, in President Bush's case, he clearly has no credibility because of lying to us about the getting us into this war.
When I was up on Capitol Hill 2 weeks ago and I was invited up by the Democratic skeptics, this was striking to me, the extent to which the number of times different members of Congress said to me in the course of the afternoon, we cannot trust this administration. They lied to us about Iraq. They lied to us about the Patriot Act. They have no credibility left. People a little higher up, in terms of being a little closer to the negotiations, were more inclined to be to give Henry Paulson specifically the benefit of the doubt. But for the rank and file members that I was talking to, it was the administration as a whole, and they weren't being generous in drawing distinctions.
But it's almost, Dr. Garbeth, you're almost talking about January the 21st with the assumption that it'll be Barack Obama, because you're talking about change, and it's not likely that, but based upon John McCain's performance, his erratic performance so far, and he himself has said he doesn't know anything about the economy, I don't think there'd be much change if he were to become president.
And this is a choice the American public have to make. I'm not, for the purposes of our discussion today, making any assumption about what's going to happen on November 4th, but it's clear the public has to choose. And I actually think when John McCain says he doesn't know anything about the economy, this is a smokescreen. The guy was chairman of the Commerce Committee. He has been closely associated with the major forces behind deregulation and desupervision. He was deeply involved in the Keating Five scandal 20 years ago. This is a guy who knows a lot. The problem is not what he doesn't know, but what he does know and what he has done and what his basic philosophy of governing is.
Well, there's a possibility that his Secretary of the Treasury will be the very person who, in an article you wrote in Mother Jones recently, James Galbraith, thanks to Phil Nation of Whiners Graham, the former Texas senator who until recently was John McCain's top economic advisor, foreclosure Phil, futures market regulations went to hell after the Enron loophole pushed through by Graham in 2000. Energy futures were allowed to escape all federal and state regulations, and that's the genesis of the unraveling. I'm surprised, in fact, that the Democrats aren't making more of foreclosure Phil.
Well, the Democrats are, in fact, talking on this issue, and there is an excellent treatment of the Keating Five issue, particularly that is up on a website called www.keatingeconomics.com. In the case of Phil Graham, the fact is, of course, he is still very closely associated with the McCain campaign. He was the guy who tried to get Ron Paul to endorse John McCain when Paul turned him down. This is really very recently, within the last month or so. I was quoted by the Washington Post as saying that he was the sorcerer's apprentice of financial instability and disaster, a guy who was basically responsible for creating the loopholes through which much of the toxic financial paper has since passed. And that's, again, it raises the question of trust and confidence about any movement from this administration to if there were a McCain administration.
Well, I think you have to add to that the damage that Graham did, given that there's $62 trillion of the so-called credit default swaps that people don't know the exact value of them. And all the while this was going on, and Phil Graham opened the floodgates, but the person sitting there in charge of the Fed appeared to have been a big booster of derivatives and all this stuff. I mean,
well, he was, of course. He was the author of the legislation that legitimized credit default swaps. What is a credit default swap? It's basically an insurance policy without reserves. The reason people don't know what the value is it's impossible to say what the value is. It's basically a house of cards. And when the house of cards crumbles, of course, there's a chain of failures that becomes possible. That's what happened that forced the intervention in the case of the insurance company AIG a couple of weeks ago. Mm. Let me take this back, though, to a theme which I talk about in detail and develop as a line of economic argument in the predator state. The problem here is a misunderstanding of the role of regulation. The conservative philosophy has been that there is a kind of opposition, an adversarial relationship between the government and the market, and their position is the less government, the better, the more deregulated, the better, because the government acts as a kind of incubus on the market. I take a very different view. I argue that there is no market without a regulatory presence, because in any complex society, whether you're talking about the food chain, whether you're willing to eat fresh vegetables, whether you're talking about the water that you drink, or whether you're talking about electrical appliances, do you dare plug them into the wall, or whether you're talking about financial instruments, fundamentally, there needs to be trust that that the interests of the consumer, of the user, have been protected and looked out for. And I can go in and buy a used book or a new book even, and it doesn't really matter whether there's whether someone has certified it to be a good book. I can only lose $25 or $30. But if I go and buy a mortgage-backed security, I need to have some assurance that it's a reliable instrument. That's what rating agencies are for. The rating agencies failed in that responsibility. Fundamentally, these markets only work when the regulatory agency, whether it's public or private, is doing its job, when there's a cop on the beat. And that's a line of argument, I think, that liberals in particular have not made forcefully enough in recent decades. But it is, I think, fundamental to an understanding of why advanced industrial developed societies get developed and stay developed. And that is something I try to bring out as a basic point of philosophy and practice in the predator state.
And given the black hole, if you will, that Greenspan unquestionably was an enabler of, I mean, Warren Buffett described derivatives as an economic weapon of mass destruction. Is it possible, in where we were talking earlier about triage in terms of how much the taxpayer should be taken down to compensate for the bad activities of these actors? Is there a way that you can that they can cancel each other out? If these big players conned each other, shouldn't they both go down?
Well, you need to have a functioning and effective financial system, a payment system. There needs to be a way in which people can get mortgages, in which they can get consumer credit, in which companies can get short-term corporate paper and finance their activities. This is what's at risk at the present time. It's at risk because of a fundamental breakdown of trust between financial institutions. As you say, the officials who were behind fostered the instruments that destroyed trust, and Alan Greenspan certainly plays a major role in this, but then so does George Bush and the people he put in charge of the regulatory agencies, and so does Phil Graham and the people who were allied with him, including John McCain. They really do not belong in political life. They need to be on the sidelines, because there is no way they can effectively restore trust, because, as I said, they have a credibility problem. Even if they were serious about it, which they probably are not, nobody sensible is going to believe them, given their records. Beyond that, the restoration of trust is probably going to take time, and it's going to take the development of institutions which are serious about the mission of supervision and regulation in the financial sphere. And it's also going to take, let me go back to another set of issues here. It is not just that the credit channels are blocked. It is that people's houses aren't worth what they used to be worth. They're not worth the mortgages, what the mortgages obligations are. So the collateral for the kind of credit-based expansion that we've had for the last 15 years is not there. And so what is going to be needed going forward is a comprehensive revision of the terms of mortgages, so so that people can stay in their houses and you don't get cascading problem of vacant housing that's deteriorating on every block in the country. You're going to have to help to replace the demand lost because elderly people are losing the incomes on which they are basing their retirements. You're going to have to take care of state and local governments, which are losing property tax revenue, and which will react to that by cutting jobs, cutting services. And when they cut civil service jobs, of course, those people will have trouble making new mortgages. So, again, the problem will compound. There needs to be, and this has not yet been discussed as nearly as much as it has, to be, in addition to what has to be done on the financial side, there needs to be a comprehensive effort to secure the real foundations of the economy to restore the housing sector in a reasonable period of time in order for the financial fixes to work. And that's, the real sector continues to deteriorate. The financial sector cannot be propped up. That is a fundamental problem.
So, Dr. James Galbraith, it seems like you're describing a kind of the shoes dropping here when you talk about cascading. The first shoe that dropped is the subprime meltdown, which Rubini and others had warned about for some time, and that's eating its way into the into the foundations of our economy. Then the next shoe is all of those people on variable mortgages who use their homes as an ATM. Now they find their homes are worth much less than they owe for the owe. And then the third one, I think, wouldn't that be credit, household credit cards, etc.? Because that isn't that how people have endured this disconnect is by charging up everything on their credit cards?
And people will hit limits on that pretty quickly, and they will hit these extravagant interest payments that they have on unpaid balances. But no, I think the next big shoe is the problem is property tax revenues and the general revenues of state and local governments, which are causing the budget crises in every major state in the country. And that, as those lead to service cuts, that compounds the problem. And then the one after that is the failure of the of stock portfolios, and therefore, as people move into retirement and people in retirement who are drawing on those portfolios find that they don't have as much money to spend, then you have a decline in their purchasing power. So all of these things are part, as you say, a series of dropping shoes or cascading effects, and that there is going to have to be very substantial, large-scale intervention, and not necessarily fixing each one of these problems separately. I mean, one thing you could do quite sensibly is you could raise Social Security benefit by, let's say, to pick a number out of the air, 30%. You could cut payroll taxes. You could eliminate the payroll tax for, let's say, a two-year period, and that would give every working family another, 7.5% of their payroll as income that they could use to service their mortgages. This kind of comprehensive step, which is not directly geared to any particular aspect of the problem, so we're not renegotiating mortgages on it by cutting payroll taxes, but we are making it possible to service them, I think has to be thought about it going forward.
But I think in general, Dr. Galbraith, you're talking about the need for action as well as the need for imagination, aren't you?
I am, yes, but I'm also talking about action for which there is precedent in American history. And again, in the predator state, I talk about the American institutions which gave us the economy we have, and the housing finance agencies. They've been criticized justly for mismanagement, but they are in fact responsible for putting people in their homes in the 60 years since the New Deal. The Social Security system is responsible for lifting the elderly population largely out of poverty, and it works very smoothly in that respect. And I talk about a number of other institutions which are uniquely American, operate on a very large scale, and have provided a kind of stability to our economy, which we've greatly benefited from. As a dramatic contrast, one can look over at Europe. And Europe on the left has a reputation in the United States of being stable, social, democratic, protective welfare state. And that reputation actually is also burnished by the attacks one hears from the right. But the reality is really quite different. Europe, as a continental integrated economy, does not have the governing structures that we have in this country. It cannot stabilize its financial system as we can because there is no ability to issue euro credits, either to national governments who want to try to protect the deposits in their banking systems, or through the European Central Bank, doesn't function as the Fed does as a lender of last resort. So So one of the reasons why the dollar has actually been getting stronger and the euro weaker is a great sense of uncertainty about whether European governing mechanisms are actually up to the job of stabilizing this very complicated 25-nation unit that they've now got. And it's an open question. It's very questionable that the European governing authorities know what they're doing any better than ours do, and maybe even not so well. And that's a great source of worry and instability, which is actually more or less outside the control of U.S. policymakers at the moment.
Well, just in closing, Dr. Galbraith, you know, I mentioned earlier in some of our earlier conversations, you talked about how things could have been done when things were beginning to unravel, and they weren't. I remember we also had a previous conversation about an effort on the part of the Senate to rein in oil speculating, and that was defeated. And now, of course, we're it's drilled, baby, drill. Everybody thinks we can drill our way out of this problem. But meanwhile, the price of oil has gone down to about $80 a barrel from about $150. Does that validate all our suspicions about how much the market was being gamed?
To me, it's perfectly clear that the energy price spike in the summer was a bubble, was heavily infested by speculative activity. Part of what brought the price back down was an increase in regulatory activity, CFTC taking interest in some things that it should have taken interest in months before. Looking forward, though, of course, and again, there's another major piece of the predator state of my book that deals with this. We are going to have to rebuild our energy infrastructure. We're going to have to rebuild the way we consume energy, the way we produce it. And that's not a short-term proposition. It's something which has to be thought through, planned out rather carefully over a 5, 10, 20-year horizon. One of the things about this crisis that people need to understand clearly is that it greatly strengthens the hand, relatively speaking, of Uncle Sam. The world is ready to lend to the U.S. government on very favorable terms, and it will become part of the responsibility of the government to take them up on that proposition and to start doing things that absolutely have to be done. Energy conversion, energy reconstruction, dealing with climate change is pretty high on that agenda. It is something which I would say comes in second place, or maybe in third place. The first priority is to get the liquidity issues and quell the panic. The second priority is to deal with the demand issues and make sure that the economy continues to function, keep people employed. And the third priority is to begin to think about and to act on how the United States should, what it should be doing going forward, how it should be changing as a society to maintain a high standard of living, but to make it much more sustainable. And if you can do those three things, you have the elements of an intelligible program, something which I think people can get behind and support, and something which would have some chance of working because the pieces would be working together.
So in closing, in the next few months, what happens in Washington will determine the fate of the global economy, unequivocally.
Oh, I think that's true. Well, what happens in Washington will be very important, but there will be major shocks, major uncertainty still coming from Europe and other parts of the world as well.
I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. James K. Galbraith, and for your new book, The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with James K. Galbraith, who is the author of The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. And let me just give credit here where credit is due to the producer, Louis Vandenberg, Elliot Fong and Tina Yonas, the assistant producers, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.